Good evening, James McKenna here with My Science Hour, February 17, 2022, in the ongoing series this entire year, dedicated to talking about my discoveries, my history, etc., kind of an autobiography. And the term that I'm going to use for this current series of shows is convergence of many things that happened to get me and a lot of other things in place for those few years that I was at Cornell University. And I call them the Cornell years for a very good reason, because they were instrumental in me being in the right place at the right time, also having... it's one of those things where everything came together at the right time, and that happens a lot of time in science, that you have all of these things happening at the same time, the person, the right place, the right time, the right place, etc. So this week, what I have is somewhat of a collage of topics, and so I'm just going to go through them. There may not seem to be any order, but when I went back to the 1970s, when I was out of the country, basically, doing other things, minding my business and other things, Carl Sagan, you might say my nemesis, people kid about this on radio shows that I'm on as guest, he was establishing a baseline of science. And this is carried through to today. He eventually, because of his pioneering work, I would say carrying the flag, carrying the torch of standard science, and basically defeating Velikovsky in a 25-1 shooting match at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting in 1974, where they basically took Velikovsky and roasted him. And 2 years later, Velikovsky died, being called a crazy old man, the crackpot, all of these different terms. And it turns out that Velikovsky was 100% correct in everything he did. Not everything, I shouldn't say that, because Velikovsky made some mistakes. He made some mistakes. For example, he thought that Venus, the comet, was spit out of Jupiter, out of the planet. And that's simply not the case. It was captured. But it appeared to come out of Jupiter because of the way the ancients described it. That's where the first time they saw Venus was coming out of Jupiter. That's where the mythological term Venus being born of Jupiter. Jupiter was the father of Venus, and then Venus, according to the Popol Vuh of the Mayans and to other civilizations around the world that passed down this information, according to the Popol Vuh, Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus. So anyway, getting back to good old Carl Sagan, David Duncan, chair of astronomy at Cornell, he earned his stripes, his marching badge of courage in destroying Velikovsky. And of course, they did this before any spacecraft data was obtained. They simply declared their theories correct by edict, and this carried forward until today. It is against the astronomical law to question the pillars of astronomy. At the core of this is the Dirty Snowball Comet model. And, of course, now it's more political. There are other motivations involved, but back then it was purely trying. What they were really doing is trying to prove Velikovsky wrong. And in doing so, established basically concepts which were totally incorrect, which then had to be adhered to. As a religion, astronomy became a religious sect. And to join the religious sect, you got your PhD. And when you get your PhD, you are a sect member in the religion of modern astronomy. Okay, so anyway, West tries to hide the progress of the Russian space program. And this I saw firsthand because they had the opportunity of working with Russian scientists, and they would laugh, but they would also acknowledge that if they said something in public, nobody in the West would believe it, because who would believe a Russian? Because according to the Western kind of the picture that's been painted of Russians is that they're a bunch of lying thieves. And to the contrary, I found them to be very honest, hardworking people. They did not work for a paycheck, I can tell you that. They did get paid, and at the time when I was working with them around the mid-1990s, they were getting $75 equivalent per month, living in a barrack situation on campus at the University of Novosibirsk. And so anyway, I'll be talking more about those topics in a while. And so something else, it's a good time to bring this topic up because it'll be recurring throughout the this year. And of course, I've talked about this before. It's in my, I discuss this a lot, the tier level of scientists, what I've defined as tier one, tier two, tier three level, and even tier four level science. And so let's take level four would be maybe your journalist graduate student who has now become a science writer, and they repeat what NASA tells them in the popular press. They bring you the stories and basically accentuate them to try and make them sound really gee whiz, like NASA's really doing this great stuff or standard science, etc. So that would be tier four. Tier three would be like university college level astronomy teachers, who, example, use a textbook and teach out of that. And they probably typically don't publish papers. They may have an interest in amateur astronomy of some kind. They may do some kind of writing. They might have a column in a local newspaper about the astronomical events of the month or something like that. But they're not considered visibly as top scientists. And then there's the level two scientists, which would be university professors in astronomy, astrophysics, space science, who publish, who have maybe active research, who might be NASA scientists, etc. And this is tier two science, as Carl Sagan would have been a tier two scientist. Tier one science is what I call it military science, because it is secret science. In other words, and I've often said this too, people criticize me, why don't I publish in peer-reviewed journals? Peer-reviewed journals are tier two science. Real science does not get published, ever, and especially in peer-reviewed journals. Peer review is that game that's played to keep the funding cycle. It's funding, peer review publication, tenure, and university professors or NASA scientists or JPL scientists, etc. Those are tier two levels of science. Tier one science, you will never see. You don't hear about it. One of the best examples I will give you here, I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting, and if you're not familiar with these, there's 20,000 scientists that converge on a convention center for a week. And when I attended these to give presentations, I was typically in a presentation in an auditorium with a table and a poster, for example. So anyway, that's the venue. And then there are what they call sessions. And they're basically small classroom-type sessions for people who are interested. And you can go to these. You can attend these as you want. You can sign up beforehand, or you pretty much can walk into them, because they're not typically not crowded unless there's something big going on. Then they would have to have a bigger area for all the people who are interested in listening to this on a general interest level. But I was at a session. It was not highly populated. It was a session dealing with the characteristics of solar physics. And so I'm in the audience, and the presenter is presenting about his findings about solar wind and various things that they had been studying. And he said that part of their contract is always they have to send it up to the next tier level. And this guy would have clearly been a tier two scientist. He was doing research. He worked for NASA. He was involved in, he probably related to a university or JPL or Goddard or one of the locations. And so he said that he always, part of his contract, his grant money, was that he had to send his findings up to the next level. He didn't know who he was sending them to. He just had an address, email address, or a website address to upload his information. And so anyway, at the end of the talk, somebody raises their hand and asks the question, well, what did they respond to you? Did they agree with your research? Did they acknowledge it? Did they like it? Did they not like it? Did they criticize it? He said, oh, they never write back to us. We don't even know who it is. But it's part of their requirement to upload their research. But he said, yeah, they never respond to us. And he admitted in that statement that he knew that he was a tier two scientist, that there was a whole layer of science above him of which he knew nothing, and that potentially took his work. If they liked it, they used it. If they didn't, they didn't use it. I can tell you how this works, is I've had tier one scientists come out and talk to me. And in those circles, I'm considered a tier one scientist. And you'll hear that on a lot of radio shows when people introduce me as a tier one scientist. Because it's just a level that's international in scope, and it includes the scientists who are making actual discoveries, real discoveries that are true, that can be verified, etc. And so, anyway, those are the four tier levels of science. But for the average person, say at the university level, there are three levels of science, tier one, two, and three. But tier one science is that military grade science. You never see the people. You don't know who they are. They don't publish in any kind of peer-reviewed journals, etc. So it's important to understand this in the context of what we're dealing. So Carl Sagan was not a Tier 1 scientist, never would be. And most of the people you saw around the Voyager and the Pioneer spacecraft or the other spacecraft that went to Venus or Mars, these are not Tier 1 scientists. These are tier two scientists, and I can guarantee you that tier one science has much better satellite and reconnaissance data at, for example, Mars, than you will ever see. And they have access to a lot of the data, like with the Galileo or the Cassini probes. They would have had access to other equipment potentially on those spacecraft that would not be even seen by the tier two scientists. The Russian scientists told me that they had tried to go to the moon, and this was an effort just to orbit the moon and come back. And they had done this in the 1960s, well before the alleged Apollo moon landing in 1969. The Russians said their cosmonauts came back very dead from radiation burns, severe radiation burns, and that's because of the Van Allen belt. So they knew that there was a problem there, and that's why they knew that NASA never went to the moon, one of the reasons, and they just laughed about it. But they tried, and they never went back to the moon. Russia had full capability, and they began their low Earth orbit program much sooner than the United States. The United States was still flaunting the Apollo moon program. And I mentioned last week, I talked about the dates of the Apollo launches running up to April 17th. Apollo 17, it was in December of 1972, and that was the last Apollo mission that allegedly went to the moon. And after that, NASA started using the Saturn V's to support Space Lab, and eventually totally dismantled the Saturn V rocket complex completely and destroyed all of the records, which would be criminal in any situation, but The reality is that they got away with it, and basically covering their tracks. Now, I want to mention one other group of satellites that turned out to be very instrumental, and these were used all the way up into the 1980s. And this was a series of spacecraft called the ISEES. These were solar monitoring satellites that went out, most of them far away from Earth, in the Earth magnetosphere border crossing between the solar wind and our protected magnetosheath that's typically around 30,000 miles out to the sunward sign of Earth. But there was the ISEE 1, 2, and 3. And the ISEE 3, eventually, there was a scientist, a good scientist, James Farquhar, who was the head of that and had the idea with his staff to, as it was a dying satellite, to reroute it to go out to a comet and to, in a sense, take the thunder away from the visit to Halley's Comet, which occurred. But see, NASA did not ever have a spacecraft intended to go to Halley's Comet. You had the European JATO spacecraft, which flew to the sunward side at my bidding. I don't know if they did it because of me, but I told, I put in my 2 cents at worth that the real action is to the sunward side of the comet, not in the tail side. Because on the sun, in fact, JATO spacecraft ran into the electron beam and recorded it in all of its full glory. That's another story. I'll be talking about that later. But the NASA did not have a spacecraft intended to go to Comet Halley. There were 4 total spacecraft. NASA didn't have a player. So anyway, James Farquhar, with the ISEE-3 satellite, and a staff who I got to meet at American Geophysical Union meetings, because what they did is they rerouted this satellite that was an aging satellite. It still had a little bit of life on it, left on it. They rerouted it to go through the tail region right behind the nucleus of a comet called Giacobini Center. And so anyway, that was a very interesting time and a very interesting experiment, because it was the first spacecraft ever to fly close to a comet. And so, in fact, I have a paper that was presented at the American Geophysical Union meeting on, I forget the year, that's going back there quite a ways now. But and I met one of the lead scientists, physicists from Goddard on that. His name was Tycho von Rosenbinger. And I met with him in a very interesting we had the session at the American Geophysical Union meeting. It was held in San Francisco. And at that meeting was another reporter called Jonathan Eberhardt. Jonathan was a reporter for a magazine called Science News. And it was a magazine that came out weekly. It was very interesting because everybody was very congenial. We talked about, they knew about my work, of course, that comets were not dirty snowballs. And so anyway, I, through my talking with Jonathan Eberhardt, got him to write an article in Science News, who mentioned me and the questionable nature of the dirty snowball comet model, which at the time was called the ice ball comet model. And it was interesting that the ISEE-3 satellite was renamed ICE, for ice, in anticipation of being an ice ball. So the ISEE-3 satellite then became the ICE, or ICE-3 satellite, as it went out to Comet Giacobini-Zinner, anticipating that it was an ice ball. But back to the Jonathan Eberhardt story. Jonathan wrote this article in Science News, and he really got taken to the cleaners. They got down on him. And so anyway, I called him up one day. It's Jonathan, this is James McCanny. He said, don't ever call me again. Don't ever talk to me. He was very serious that they had basically taken him to the cleaners. And if he ever mentioned anything like that again, he would well, let's just say he would have some problems. And so that just gives you the level of paranoia that these people had of any commentary negative against the Dirty Snowball Comet bottle. As I said at the time, back in the Jacobini's inner days, was the Dirty Ice Ball Comet model. Okay, so once again, all of these things converging by the time that I got to Cornell. Now, the ISEE3, that was later. What was that? Was probably, let me pull up the year here. This occurred in September of 1985. So this was just a few years after I had been after I had left Cornell, and I was still very active in this the American Geophysical Union meetings, and active as far as relating my work to people, etc. But I find it comical now that if you look up the ICE, the International Cometary Explorer, as they call it, or ICE, 3 satellite, they will say it supported the Dirty Snowball Comet model. Well, it did anything but that. But if you want to look with myopic vision, then, as always, they can say anything. But what's very comical, too, is the story about Jonathan Eberhardt, how he wrote an article disparaging the Dirty Snowball Comet model and was severely reprimanded. And to the point of him, like I say, when I called him up, I said, "Jonathan, James McCanny here." He said, "Don't ever call me again. Don't ever talk to me again." And he was just, very much he had been threatened, clearly, that he could not talk about that anymore. Okay, so I'm going to switch some other topics here. Now, going back to when I lived in Mexico City, so this would have been 1971, a gentleman named Thor Heyerdahl came to Mexico City, and I was living there. I got wind of it. And so the night he appeared, he had a conference at a big conference hall there, an auditorium. And if you're not familiar with Thor, he is the author of a couple of wonderful books, Aku Aku, and Kon-Tiki. And when I was in high school, during the summertime, I was in high school, I read both those books, and they were very inspirational for me. So when he ended up in Mexico City at the same time I was there, he was looking for funding for his latest project. And I can't remember what it was, but it was an exploratory project. And just to give you a flavor, Aku Aku is about the big stone heads on Easter Island. And his exploratory trips relative to those, a very good book, and very inspirational for me. And then Kon-Tiki was about his quest to connect Polynesia with Peru. And there are a lot of other people who also believe there's a connection between the Peruvian cultures, the Incas, and the Polynesian cultures. And so anyway, if you go up to Lake Titicaca, which I've been to personally, and out on the reef, the reed boats, and on the reed island that is out there, he made a reed boat. And his goal was to float with the currents across the ocean to make a connection between Polynesia and Peru. And I remember his first trip, the ends of the boat sank, and they kept sinking and sinking, and he didn't realize, but then he went back and he looked at the drawing of the boats, and it had a post in the middle. It wasn't really like a mast, but it was a post that stuck out vertically out of the center of the reed boat, and it had lines going to the bows. And once he put that in to Kon-Tiki, the boat, then he was able to cross the ocean, and he made this a fantastic story. Well, anyway, talk about an adventurer, a guy that would do this, take his own time and money and do this. So anyway, he ends up in 1971 in Mexico City looking for funding. So I went to the meeting, and just a great speaker, a lot of rich people in Mexico City. And so he was soliciting money for his latest project. But I just want to mention that because he was an inspiration to me. And maybe that was the reason why I was even in Mexico City or had an interest in traveling to these remote places to study archaeology. And just basically, when you're an explorer, you follow your nose. It's like you don't know where this is going to lead to, but you just know there's adventure there and you're out there following wherever that path may take you. Okay, so I want to revert back to a couple ruin sites in Mexico, one relatively near Mexico called Xochicalco. And famous for, number one, nobody really knows who built it. It was pre-Aztec, and it follows very much the theme of the Maya, who predated the Aztec, of course. And in Xochicalco is a pyramid dedicated to the plumed serpent, or the feathered serpent, as they call it, clearly referencing Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, which is representative of Venus. And so that's a location that's very impressive. It sits up on a hillside overlooking a massive valley off into the distance. And then also, when I was in Mexico City, a friend of mine got wind through a contact archaeologist there named Carmen Cook, who had worked with her husband on archaeological digs until her husband died, and then she continued the work. But anyway, word came out that there was a newly discovered pyramid, just, I think it was down near Toluca. And so at any rate, I was able to go out to that site and stayed there for a number of weekends. And so anyway, on the site, it was dry. It was the dry season. And so everybody slept in hammocks, and there was a little town nearby that, oddly enough, was a fireworks factory. And in fact, I took my students to the fireworks factory. Just a little caveat here. When I was teaching at the school there, I took my students on a field trip to the fireworks factory. And the one order I had from the school was that nobody could buy fireworks. Well, of course, they all did. And on the way back, I had to take them because these students could not get off the bus with the hierarchy of the school standing there with fireworks. So I took all the fireworks and had a couple of very good experiences shooting off fireworks. And but at any rate, next to this ruins that had been newly discovered was the fireworks factory. So the workers for the dig came from the little town. And it was just, like a walk up the hillside. And so anyway, the story was that a farmer was digging on the top of this hill. He was planting his corn, and the corn would never grow on the top of the pyramid, on the hill. I'm sorry, he didn't know it was a pyramid yet. So anyway, he starts digging, and he digs into the top of this pyramid. And so I got to go out there on site, and as they dug with these big rock masks and other artifacts that had been there since the time they were left there by the people who lived there, actually pre-Aztecs, more related to the Yucatan Maya, it appears. But at any rate, some interesting things happened there. In the morning, the women from the town would come out, and they would have a series of coffee cans, like literally these old-fashioned 2-pound coffee cans, and they would take corn from the husks, the mazorcas, and take the seeds off and put them in a can with water. And they'd let them soak all day. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they would take them out with a mortar and pestle and start making them into tortillas, corn tortillas. And every worker got 2 corn tortillas. That was their daily food allotment. And I ate those. And I'll tell you, after a day at the site, there was nothing that tasted better than your 2 corn tortillas, and made on an open fire with an open grill, etc., with a clay cooking surface. Wow, I mean, that was amazing. But anyway, something very interesting happened there. there was a man that would that they would bring out every day, and they put him in a hammock, and he would sing this song. This is very curious. He would sing this song in Spanish, and he would sing, "I'll never see Veracruz again. I'll never see Papantla." And he'd go through this whole litany of all the places he would never see again. And so finally, I asked this lady, I said, "What's this guy's story? What happened? What's he, you know, he comes out here every day and they wait on him hand and foot. They bring him food and take care of him and bring him water to drink." And she goes, "Oh, he's dying." And I'm like, okay, he's dying. What's he dying from?" She said, "A spider bite." And I said, "Well, how long has he been like this?" She said, "About 10 years. I thought, "Oh my goodness, this guy has got the best gig in town. Everybody waits on him hand and foot. He just lays in the hammock all day singing about how he won't see all of these Mexican cities. And he's had a spider bite 10 years ago. And he's still dying and they still accept it." But that was the culture, you know, the culture was just very accepting, I think it's comical for us to look at, but they didn't have a concept of time. And then I realized, wow, these people have, you know, they have no concept of time of 2 weeks ago or 3 months ago or whatever. To the contrary, the hierarchy of the Aztecs, etc., were very conscious of time. And they had a cycle of 52 years in the Mayan culture that was is like a Passover event. In fact, it was a Passover event where they would go into huts and they would completely seal them off and they would stay inside. And this is the exact same event as the Hebrew Passover. The Israelites who were leaving Egypt with Moses while the comet Venus was coming by, and it happened at the same time. In fact, there's a group in North Dakota, I think it's North Dakota, an indigenous group who happened to be fair-skinned, blue-eyed Native Americans who also have a Passover event where they celebrate. But it wasn't every year, it was every 52 years, according to the Mayan calendar. And if there was no devastation due to the planet Venus when they came out of their huts, they would put another layer on their temple cities. And so that's why these cities were originally built on the old gridwork. And this is something that became very important when I finally went back with in the mid-90s with surveying equipment into these areas like Chichen Itza and Uxmal and Tulum, and measured on the ground with surveying equipment. It turns out that they coordinate with the old North Pole. So anyway, it had the Mayans had what is considered to be the best calendar, long-term calendar. And I'll mention this too, that people made a mistake. They're trying to extrapolate the Mayan calendar back into history. And they talk about the year zero of the Mayan calendar, etc. That's incorrect because the Mayan calendar is based on recent movements of the planets and the moon, etc. And they're very much aware of the fact that the calendars had changed some point in time. Velikovsky puts that date at around 1500 BC, and it's the best reckoning that I have found, although I personally don't pick dates, and especially calendar dates, either in the past or certainly not in the future. But very interesting that the Mayan calendar was based on this 52-year cycle of Venus, not the sun, not the moon, but Venus. And this is because Venus had 52 years between the first encounter with Earth, which was not that bad, and the second encounter, which was very bad. And that's when Venus was working its way into the inner solar system to become planet Venus we see today. And of course, the process is through what I call tail drag, the plasma discharge comet model. That's the process by which large comets lose their orbital energy. And the two effects, one is the circularization of the orbit. The other one is energy reduction. So it drops down into smaller and smaller orbits, as with the planet Venus. So that's why that's how a comet that's outside of Earth's orbit could become a comet that is outside Earth's orbit, how it could become a planet inside of Earth's orbit. And of course, that was always one of the big bugaboos that science could not figure out. And one of the other things that I discovered was the tail drag being used, and I've already talked about that, and my early work defining what comets really are, and that very important process of how large comets become planets. Okay, so this is also a very good time to talk about the differentiation between the modern Aztecs, the modern Maya, and the ancient civilizations that lived in those same areas. The Toltecs, of course, came much earlier. In the Toltec warriors, they are called. These are the figures, the columns that stand up north of Mexico City. And in the case of the Mayas, the Olmecs populated the Yucatan Peninsula area, and literally thousands of years before the modern Maya. So the modern Maya constitute a period of around 800 to around 1300 AD. That's where they flourished. That's where they rejuvenated their culture based on Quetzalcoatl, building their cities on top of the old gridwork. The Aztecs were in existence and going full steam ahead when the Spanish showed up in the 1500s. And so the cities like Monte Alban or the cities like Xochicalco were pre-Aztec or pre-modern Aztec, and nobody really knows who built them or when they were built, or really you can tell why they were built, but as because they are astronomical importance. But they are all related to this plumed serpent god of the night sky, Venus. And once again, you look at Venus today, it's just a little dot up in the sky. Why would these people put so much credence into the story of Venus? Well, that's because Venus was a large comet. It came through the solar system and ravaged Earth on two successive occasions and then nestled into the orbit where we see it today. So it was a major part of history. It was like, I've mentioned this before, for thousands of years, these people carried on the tradition of honoring and having holidays relative to the events around the comet Venus. And so it's similar to, for example, Christ. You know, thousands of years later, people are still celebrating the life and death of Christ. And so this is very similar. It was one of those formative events where all of history changed. And you can mark, for example, minor events like, you know, Julius Caesar or the Xerxes with the Persian Empire, or you can mark these other major events in human history, the world wars of the 20th century, etc. But none of them match the significance of, for example, the birth of Christ, or the Quetzalcoatl, which was in the ancient books. And also, eventually, when the Colburn came out, these very much relate to the same events that we're talking about here. So all of these various topics in world history converging, but people in general not understanding how to interpret it. And then you have the wrench in the entire works of modern astronomy trying to dictate ancient, corrupt, poorly designed theories that don't make any sense even on the surface. They don't explain 99% of the data, and just being promulgated and really being the bane of true understanding. Okay, I've got about 20 minutes left in this show, and I'm going to go through a whole series of things that exposed me not only to the brutality and the destruction of the Spanish of these civilizations. The Mayans were still in existence when the Spanish came, and they really didn't have that much gold. The Yucatan did not produce that much gold, but the Aztecs did. Had vast amounts of the gold, and I believe the Incas probably even had more. But what's strange about the Incas is that the Spanish had to go around into the Pacific Ocean to get it, or cross across the peninsula of South America to bring it and load the ships up and bring it back to Spain. But I'll be talking about the Inca walls that were just capped in gold, and I'm not just talking about a layer or a little thin layer. I'm talking about walls that were maybe 3 meters thick and maybe 3 meters high, and then covered with maybe a 2 meter cap of solid gold surrounding this entire complex in Cusco, which you can still go see. But the you can see the wall and the vast amount of gold that had been accumulated, of course, over the centuries. And the Spanish took it and melted it down into what they called pieces of eight, which was they took. So you can even I can't even imagine some of the artifacts that would have been there if the Spanish would not have done this. Just unbelievable in the name of Christ, of course. But a piece of eight is a golden coin that is split into four pieces with a cross in the middle of it on one side and then a cross on the other. So there's a division of four on one side and four on the other side. So four plus four is eight. So pieces of eight was the term. And, you know, the gold doubloons or pieces of eight that the pirates used to talk about, etc., that's what they were talking about. But the gold that came out of the New World was unbelievable. And so the other thing is that the Spanish and the Portuguese and all of this, the English, of course, they all learned that the hard way, especially like when Columbus went back to after his very first trip, he had the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. And by the time he got back to Spain, the two of the ships had been completely eaten away by worms that you have in the tropics, where they attacked this temperate climate wood and just eat it out from under you. And I've had wooden boats in the tropics, and so you have to use a copper-laden paint to kill to keep anything from growing on it. Still, barnacles will grow on it, etc. You have to keep it clean, but the worms, if you don't have protected wood, like for a pine or oak or any of the standard wood building materials from the north, those worms will eat it right out from underneath you. And so anyway, the point is that the Spanish needed a different kind of wood to build their big ships out of. And of course, the tropics would be where you would get that. So this was the first cut. And I've been in these regions of the tropics where there are still original forests of these big trees, and you feel like an ant. You feel like a micro ant when you're next to these trees. They just go up into the sky. And so what this is what the Spanish were able to harvest to build these massive navies with. And these were big ships. These were 200 feet long, and they ballasted them with gold. Then they had that much gold that they could put it in the ballast of these ships. And every ship had a manifest, which was the log of what was on the ship. And that was kept at port, so they knew if the ship was lost, they knew what was lost. And they also knew that when it arrived at the inbound port, that somebody didn't make off with some of the goods. So every item on these boats was contained in the ship manifest. So these ships, some of them were lost en route. In fact, off of the Dominican Republic coast, there are 26 of these vessels which sank when they were coming up from South America or in the Caribbean or from Mexico. They would come they all passed through a passage. It was the biggest passage that in the Caribbean between islands. It's called the Mona Passage. It's between Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic. It's about a 100-mile wide channel with heavy currents and heavy winds, etc. So for these ships, which were old square riggers, to make their way up through this channel was very difficult. And to make it worse, there's right out in the middle was a very shallow island that it did not break. In fact, I've been on top of that with a boat looking over the side of the boat, looking down at cannons with reef growing all over them because of the ships that were lost there. But at any rate, the manifest would tell what was on the boat. So they know what was on these 26 ships that are missing. And not, they're not missing. They know where they were. They went aground. And they're in relatively deep water, so there's heavy currents and it's very hard to get to them, but very much protected by the Dominican Republic government, because these ships have ballasts of gold, absolute by today's standards, absolutely massive amounts of gold. Now, I had another way of looking at this, and so there's a number of ways when the Spanish were raiding and pillaging the Mexico, Central America, Latin America, South America. This gold made its way back to these countries, which were all controlled by the Vatican. At this point, the Vatican held the control over the kings and queens that ran these various countries, arranged weddings, arranged wars, manipulated the commerce, etc., and also in this time became fabulously wealthy. So this wealth is what became the basis for the modern Vatican Bank, otherwise known as the World Bank, or the Rothschild Bank is another name for it, the Red Shield Rothschild Bank, and they currently control out of Germany, oddly enough, but the Bank of England is also related to this worldwide banking network, of which the United States is a colony still, if you haven't figured that out. So that the banking system in the United States, which controls everything, is the elections and the president and all of that is a big facade, because the real controllers run out of the Federal Reserve, which is a branch of the Bank of England, which is a branch of the International Monetary Fund or the Rothschild Banking Empire. So there are 26 ships that didn't make it, of hundreds of ships that did make it back to the old world. And basically all of this money funneled through England, Spain, Portugal, Italy, through other Dutch East Indies Company, for example, was big on the slave trade. You want to know where the slave trade came to bring the blacks from Africa to the United States. It was the Dutch East India Company, which was also a branch of the World Bank, run by the same people out of the Northern European countries, Netherlands, etc. So why is this important? Because today, the same groups basically own science. When you're a scientist today, of which this is why I have never personally signed up to be to work for the government or work for anybody like NASA or etc., is because I had no interest, because I knew at each stage of my career of the corruption that was going on, and I never knew it as fully as I do right now. But putting all of these aspects of history together will give you an understanding of who controls basically the world governments. China, people talk about China being a threat to the United States. Well, the same bank that runs China runs the United States. And this international Cold War that's been going on for decades is Russia, 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 or China, 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 etc. These are all facades. Because, and the whole idea is to keep the people down, keep them thinking that, oh, that country is against us, or Russia is against us, or we're against them, or whatever, is all a facade to keep the entire world population under control. In the third world countries, there's a book, if you have not read it, it's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And it talks about the CIA, how they go into a country, and they are the police force of the World Bank. I keep repeating that because that's who they are. They're not some kind of protectorate of the United States. They are the police force of the World Bank, who operates basically out of the United States using the resources of the United States and the intel community, basically to control the world, to have to cause chaos, to cause problems, to manage resources, to go in and give loans to countries that cannot possibly pay them back, to have the corrupt officials sign on to these loans, and then when the country can't pay them back in 10 years, the international corporations, which are also run and operated by the banks, the same banking cartels, go in and rape and pillage the natural resources, leaving the people in the dirt. And so if you want to know where all of the poverty comes from in these countries, that's where it is. That's where it's based. This has been going on for hundreds of years, as noted by the dates. We're talking about early 1500s. But this massive amount of gold is what gave the bank, the Vatican Bank, its shot in the arm to become the World Bank that we see today. I want to talk a little bit about the Incas, because in Cusco there's a wall, and I mentioned this, and I suggest you go see it. In fact, I should mention too that about probably 80 to 90% of the Inca structures that were in Cusco originally were cut up and used to make the churches there, the cathedrals that are in Cusco. So the Inca ruins, very few, maybe 10 to 20% of them remain. But there was a city, basically a walled city, where the hierarchy of the Incas were when the Spanish showed up. And this wall is probably about 3 meters thick, solid, big, massive stones, megalithic-style stones put together to make this wall. And it's, I think it's about 3 meters thick. It might be more. But capped on the top of this was a cap of solid gold. And so, I mean, this cap would have been enough to ballast probably many, many ships. Because, and so this was taken off and then removed and taken back to Spain. This is the vast amount of wealth in the name of gold and resources and timber. Now, there's another aspect of the timber I want to talk about. How do you get these trees from where they were felled to make these Spanish ships? How do you get them to the coast where they're making the ships? There's only one solution, and that is slave labor. Now, I've talked before about there's a movie, and this Spanish a priest was instrumental in the murder of countless Native Americans in Peru. And so anyway, he went back and as a penance created a cross out of hardwood and walked up this river, and as his penance, for self-inflicted penance, for the murder of all of these Native Americans. But of course, at this point, how do you bring them back? They're gone. But the point is that the Native American populations were used as slave labor to move the wood. How else would they get the wood to the coast, where the Spanish then used it to make ships? And this was one in the trafficking back to the old world also. You had lumber, timber, plants, you had people, slaves, and gold. And so the deepest part of the hull was filled with gold. And that's why the pieces of eight were made, because it was much easier than bringing artifacts, or disorganized into statues or whatever else. And can you only imagine what was destroyed and turned into pieces of eight, enough to fill hundreds of ships with gold, with ballast, untold amount of wealth transferred and stolen from these people. And of course, the Incas knew that the Spanish were going to pillage their goods, etc. So they moved part of it to Machu Picchu, up to other places, and it is said that a lot of this treasure, not only gold, but a lot of information, a lot of secret documents, etc., and the official beliefs, etc., books, were taken by the Incas and hidden, and they've never been found. So very interesting. And I just also want to mention that eventually I ended up going to Peru and discovered that the Nazca lines were in fact radio antennas. And so that's part of my work on the Nazca lines. The mystery resolved. It's a white paper I have on my webpage as part of my work. But there again, if you look at the Inca culture, central to the Inca culture is a Quetzalcoatl type of character going back to thousands of years ago when Venus, and this is definitely Venus, there's no question about it, it's not the sun, it's not the moon, it's not anything else. Quetzalcoatl is related to Venus. And the plumed serpent god of the night sky whose heart became the planet Venus. The same as the Mayas, the same as the Aztecs. That's why I also was talking about visiting the city Xochicalco, which is the a pre-Aztec city. They don't know who built it or why, just like the Toltecs. They don't know who built it or when or exactly why. But these were pre-Aztec civilizations in mid-Mexico. And the Xochicalco having the pyramid of the feathered serpent, and of course the feathered serpent is the comet Venus, and all of the characteristics personified or in a abstract art form. Okay, so this was somewhat of a collage of information gleaned from this time of my life, the 1970s, and information that eventually came to light on the condition of the world, and especially the scientific world and the archaeological world, as we come up to today. The belief systems, etc., which are totally false, and the explorers who were trying to put this together, the past together, like Thor Heyerdahl, for example, who I mentioned at the beginning. I'm out of time. Remember the webpage, jmccsci.com, and the water filter webpage, JMCC Water Filters, where you can still get 10% off from any purchases there using the coupon code JMCC. You can get a 10% discount on any orders. And yes, I do have the HI filters in stock. They will be in stock. We're keeping ahead of the demand there, and I believe I'm the only person that has filter elements for gravity systems in stock. So go there, and we'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.